we lande con inia inia ia 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 oh 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 inia inia
My name is Sandra Yellowhorse. I am Diné from the Navajo Nation, and I live and labor on the lands of Ngāti Whātua and Tainui, and acknowledge myself as a grateful guest in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Yeah, we're like separated by a day, so it was kind of tricky, but I'm glad we managed to make this work. I want to say thank you for joining me on this episode. And the reason why I reached out was because of this article that you had recently published. And, you know, a lot of the themes resonate with my work on development, but also this idea of like colonialism and capitalism. And the article that you wrote is called Disability and Indigenous Resistance, Mapping Value Politics During the Time of COVID-19. Already the title catches my eye, just because it combines everything I'm looking for when I'm like searching for articles to cite. As I understand it, you know, I think what's useful about this is the way that it brings together ideas of Indigenous resistance, settler colonialism, capitalism, and then more specifically, like the politics that arise of that like value certain things and peoples and lands differently, that I think is pretty prevalent, but for the most part really isn't applied to the Navajo Nation. I think there's only a few people I've seen that like talk about like wastelanding and, you know, like the devalue of like Indigenous people, like border towns. So in this case, though, you talk about disability, a theme that tends to be overlooked or doesn't really get much attention. And I'll be honest, it's something I'm starting to learn and, you know, change my grammar so that it's not so ableist and, you know, like kind of set forth and create an alternative. The article explores these particular themes within the Navajo Nation during the COVID pandemic. In this, you talk about productivity. I was curious if you could elaborate on like, what is capitalist productivity in relation to like settler colonialism?
Yes, well, thank you for that. You know, when I started kind of researching Native history in general, there's this idea of land for development for profit, right? And that's one of the underpinning features of settler colonialism, the dispossession of Indigenous people for their land. So when I started thinking about kind of the history of dispossession within the context of the United States, that was always kind of a prevailing theme. And I mean, I referenced it in the article, we have a history that speaks to that with the different legislation through the Marshall Trilogy that explicitly talks about and creates a narrative that the reason Indigenous people are being dispossessed is because they're not developing the land properly. And this kind of fueled a whole ideology of, you know, civilization, right? This civilization narrative that then was kind of appropriated into the boarding school era and the compulsory schooling that happened, where Indigenous children were forced into these school systems to learn how to develop land for profit. And that was equated to this idea of being successful, of being driven, of being self-sufficient, all of these things. And so when I wrote the article, I was really trying to just lay kind of a general history of kind of how that happened within an Indigenous context, within a Native context, to think about how is it that we create this idea of a normal, quote, right, normal rubric in which things like being productive, being, you know, keeping things moving and, you know, contributing in a certain way and how that makes someone, quote, legible, right? Makes them as a legible, productive citizen, which is what, you know, kind of what we hear in common discourse within the United States specifically, especially in terms of our politics, right? We even hear it in Navajo Nation politics, this idea of, you know, being self-sufficient. And if we really look at that idea, it comes from a very capitalist settler colonial foundation. And we have to really think about that, because if we look back at Indigenous, Native, we'll just talk about Dene people. We had really complex systems of how we cared for each other. We had very complex systems of how we cared for the land. And because of that, we were able to be, quote, sufficient, right? We were able to live in a way where there was a sense that everyone and everything was looked after in a certain way, okay? And so those two, I wanted to draw a distinction there because they're often conflated. And I wasn't quite, you know, for my engagement, wasn't quite certain that that history was apparent, especially in how some Dene people talk about this idea of success, productivity, and how that spills into our educational system. So we're looking at this long history, we're looking at the creation of education systems, we're looking at how they stem from anti-Indian racism and dispossession, and what those roots are. So that was kind of how I came to think about what, how do you think of productivity in a settler colonial context?
What you just said really made me rethink the idea of like the language of self-sufficiency. Oh, sorry. I'm like, blah, blah. Anyways. Yeah, because I never really occurred to me that some people would have maybe embedded this capitalist logic of self-sufficiency or productivity into our own idea, our own notions of like self-determination and being our own individual distinct peoples. And then that how that might even translate to individualism. You know, I've mentioned to friends of mine about more of what I've noticed as the recent co-optation of the famous Navajo phrase, if it is to be, it is up to me, where I interpret a lot of people applying like bootstrap logic to that, are like, oh, it's an individual thing. And I've always, I mean, I think originally it's kind of how I thought it was, but now I'm thinking, well, what if we make that a more collective thing? And that, so it's less about self-sufficiency, it's less about that first word and more about just being collectively collectively sufficient. I think is really interesting with what you said about this complex system of like practices and relations that aren't necessarily could be totally defined by self-sufficiency. It's more like we look after one another. So I do appreciate that clarification. I mean, yeah, I mean, kind of going based on what you just said, how does like the discourse of disability get related to like capitalist productivity?
Right. Good question. Well, you know, just to step back for a second, I think thinking about like collective caretaking is more of a like appropriate Dene concept that's based in our teachings to think about this idea of sufficiency. Because within the language of self-determination, yes, like we are distinct people, you know, and we do need our own autonomy and ways that we're developing the way we think about ourselves as a people, as a nation. But again, brought within the context of our own ancestral wisdom, which is a form of collective caretaking. And so, you know, just your reflection just then kind of shows the things that I was trying to illustrate in this article, is that the everyday language, the everyday things that we take for granted, and the ways that we understand certain terminology and kind of their divorce from this historical past, is something I really wanted to bring into focus. Because here we were in the time of COVID-19, it was a time where everything was locked down across the world. And it was a time to actually sit with what this meant, what this type of moment meant for people, to come face to face with many of the things that people with disabilities face every single day of their lives, you know, and the discourse of productivity, this idea of normality, wanting our old lives back, wanting to get back to work, all of these things, wanting to be productive, were all at the forefront of dialogue across many nation states. They were in political spaces, they were on Facebook, they were in family forums, they were widespread. and to really think about what did that dialogue actually mean? What did it mean for people with disabilities? And so I'll go back to the educational context. And if I'm interested in disability studies, disability education, and more importantly, Indigenous approaches to thinking about disability, which are not necessarily the same thing. But if we look at educational law, specifically the development of two policies, one was the Education for All Handicapped Children in 1975, and then reformed in 2004 to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. But in that first clause in 1975, and it was, this language of, we're going to give education to, these children so that they'll be able to become productive citizens and be able to contribute to society instead of remaining burdens. And I believe that's a direct quote from the actual legislation. So that whole, neoliberal view of like, oh, we're going to gift you something, we've moved past this, segregation and this process where we're not looking after, we've gone through this whole rights movement, disability rights movement, and now we're going to do the right thing. And we're going to start including disabled people into educational apparatuses and give them rights. And I'm not trying to say that this wasn't a huge win during this time. It was, because the lives that people with disabilities, their lived experiences throughout history have been horrendous, our treatment, our social treatment, political treatment of them. However, the ways in which that inclusion by absorption into a system that's predicated on capitalist logics of productivity still creates a system of violence. It says that there is a system of value that we have in which we recognize people, they're legible to us as valuable if they can do XYZ, which is usually framed within capitalist logics of productivity. Like I just mentioned, be able to produce, be able to be productive, and be able not to cost the government money, right? And that's literally how it's framed. And so the rubrics of value happen by absorption in this way, okay? These people all are pulled into this hierarchical mode of having to produce to be valuable. And so that's kind of how I conceptualize this idea of how do people become valuable within the system. And maybe I'm jumping ahead a bit, but fast forward to our current moment of COVID-19, and it became incredibly apparent that this is what was happening. Here we are, decades later, and we still have this idea of value attached to disabled bodies. Alice Wong writes about this in her work. There's lots of disability scholars and advocates, community workers who talk about this, that during this time, they were literally offered up to be harmed by the virus, as borders opened, as restrictions lifted. People were saying, oh, well, it's only the elderly and disabled that will get seriously sick, not the rest of us. The rest of us want to go back to work. We all want to go back to work and be productive because we want to be normal again. We want to have our normal lives back. And the fact that that narrative became normal, it became common, it became accepted, like it was an okay thing to say and think, really just showed how violent this system is and how these rubrics of value get applied onto people, get applied to the economy of the mind and body. And it is really based on this system that wants people to be productive, to be successful, to be developing, to make money, to continue to keep systems going. And that's literally what I was trying to map throughout this article. It's just how horrendous and horrific and how violent this system is.
Thinking about the idea of ideology, and that it's, in this case, it's like the discourse of productivity, but to me, it also hints at an understanding of the ideological aspects of productivity that influence the way we see one another and see land and other things that we might consider as resources. I like this idea that you're talking about of inclusion and absorption. When you mentioned that, it reminded me of like Coulthard's idea of like the politics of recognition. Settler states start to enter into treaty making processes with people or Indigenous people because there's some type of value, that potential value they see in it. I think of, at least with Coulthard, it seems like when Indigenous people in his book entered into treaty making process, a process of recognition, it was for gaining access to land and mining. The settler state wouldn't necessarily do that unless they saw value in that. For me, this is very helpful in thinking through kind of what we experienced, all of us, with the pandemic.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, just to kind of go back and comment on your reflection as well, you know, Glenn Coulthard's work is deeply foundational in how I came to think of all these things. Because, and I think, you know, Andrew Curley also wrote an essay in 2014 called The Origins of Legibility, right? And that really is, you know, this absorption into these systems is, in a way, absorption into these value systems, you know, which is why the essay in the end kind of takes not a comparative term, but it recenters, you know, the net thinking of value. You know, what does that mean in our community? How do we understand value? Because, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, working and developing and doing things, become, you know, but the ways in which they're contextualized are completely different because they're built on two different value systems. You know, one is serving a very small interest group, right? And that is violent to a majority of everyone in society. Whereas, you know, in terms of my Diné community and within thinking about, you know, our teachings, that kind of work and caretaking and development and growing, all of that happens in the context of community. It's for a context that helps all of us, and it helps our land, and it helps our futurity. And so that is a really key concept to think about that when thinking about this conversation and thinking about the essay. I kind of, you know, feel like, you know, in the education system, for example, just looking at the ways that we school our children, you know, even during the COVID-19 pandemic. And I touched on this, you know, the whole world was grieving. We were suffering a mass death event. There was fear, there was uncertainty, there was all this horrible stuff happening. And yet the schools were still forcing children to sit in front of Zoom. They were still forcing people to keep working, to keep doing things. And our children are so traumatized from this event. And that is just a way that productivity kind of embeds itself. But particularly, I suppose, and I wasn't in the US at the time, but this is just conversation, things that I've heard, where, you know, kids were having to go to the chapter house to log on to the internet, or parents were having to, you know, work at night because they were helping their kids all day at school. The school didn't do anything to relieve the immediacy of this idea of being productive, right? Or producing, or writing essays about, you know, whatever, you know, mediocre thing they want to write about in this moment, when we're literally facing such a profound global event. And the fact that we couldn't just sit and process and think about what was actually happening, what it meant, how we lived in relationship to it, how we could do better, what are our priorities for living a full, complete, happy, balanced life, a community life, a well-being. We're still trying to live within this system according to its rules, even though we're suffering a sort of collapse around the world. And to me, that was just the most shocking part of this whole thing within COVID-19, you know, getting the email saying, you know, you have to be on Zoom. If you don't, you're going to have to write extra work. Your kids have to complete their schoolwork. You know, I mean, they should have just given them all a pass. It just asks, you know, we should be asking ourselves, what's the point of education? You know, this is where the question is for all the critical theorists in education. Why is schooling important? Is it to help us develop more equitable societies? Is it for us to, you know, develop as a collective people, our greatest selves as human beings? Is it to create happiness? Is it to create, you know, literally it's to create wealth. It's to create wealth for a few group of people. It's to recreate the market of competition. And it's so obvious in the way our children were schooled during the time of COVID-19 that was the priority, and it was grotesque and it was violent. And it was just, you know, really hard to live through that and see it. and to see people actively participating in that as well. And I think, you know, if parents, whoever is listening to this, if they felt like something was quite not right, you're not alone. There were a lot of people, but how come we couldn't all come together as a global society and just say, we're not doing this? And I think that's really kind of how I see it in the everyday and how I'm thinking about it, and really kind of trying to appeal to people in this article and say, look, this is a time where we're all somewhat kind of experiencing something that we can make sense of these issues, you know, that are very relevant in our lives. They're not just somewhere else in theory. They're not just in the academy. They're not just in politics. They're actually in our lives. And we have agency. We have the power to think about it and to do something about it. So that's, I don't know if that answers your question.
The direction that you're taking it is the direction that I see it as well, where education is strictly for creating profit. It's to create productive, submissive workers.
So yeah, just thinking about education in terms of, you know, this rubrics of value and capitalism, my approach is really just looking at the ways in which we create systems of competition, of merit, of, you know, implanting those rubrics of value to be legible within education. And that's really where we start thinking about the meaning and the utility of things like special education. And when we start thinking about how do we actually have an education for some of our most marginalized and vulnerable people, and what does that mean?
Yeah, for me, like living on the res during the pandemic, I think I've heard stories from teachers at the Navajo Nation, and they were struggling. They were getting tired. They were getting worn out. And a lot of them felt like they just weren't being treated fairly. And this, I imagine, isn't necessarily just the Navajo Nation. It's like a lot of teachers and a lot of people during the pandemic felt that, you know, you have like people who start to develop animosity to work or start to question, you know, what is the point of working? You know, like there's no dignity. There's no like treatment of respect in this, you know, like there's not, it's, and at the end of the day, the profits for a lot of companies soared, but a lot of people themselves were struggling a lot until, like, you know, the government came in and gave us stimulus checks, and even the Navajo Nation did, and it improved material conditions. But I think it heightened people's awareness to just like the education system as to like, okay, you're putting our lives in risk. Even after we graduate, we get a job and we're essential workers and we're supposed to just like tough it out. You know, like that, yeah. I think people really question that. I think it reinvigorated like labor strategy and unionizing. And I think that's a good thing. But again, it goes back to just the idea that the US has a value rubric that the pandemic hyper-visibilized, but also at the same time, because of that, people really started to question it and politics emerged from that.
I just, like, when I'm thinking about this, I'm just thinking about, Melanie Yazzie. I attended a presentation of hers years ago, and she said something to the effect of, you don't have to have value to have the right to exist and just be, right? And to think about just what would it mean to just rest during a time such as this, right? To just look after our children, to look after their needs, to look after their emotional selves and kind of help them through this time instead of just distracting them and keeping them busy with schoolwork. I mean, my conversation with children was that this was such an oppressive time for them. They didn't like it. They felt disconnected. So what's the response? How do we actually show up for our kids? And so when I'm thinking about values, I'm really thinking about our values of caretaking children, as for an example, and as specifically caretaking our children with extra, with needs. You know, all of us have needs in some sense, but our children who have disabilities, who are marginalized, who aren't taken care of even during the best of times, right? They're overlooked in our systems, they're marginalized, their families are marginalized. How do we as a community come together for people in the everyday, beyond the pandemic, beyond all of this other stuff? And it really comes down to the principles of our principles of care and relationship, because we are taught from these teachings that where there is relationship, there is always accountability. That is the fundamental principle of reciprocal accountability that exists in interdependence. It's part of a complex system of how we caretake each other, we caretake the land, we caretake all our relations, right? And in this is a sense of belonging, is a sense of being seen, being valued, being heard, being accounted for. You're a relation within this. You're not just a person who is on a rubric or a scale of how much they can achieve or have success, all of these other things, right? They're a relative first and foremost. And that's what I kind of write about at the end, is at the end of this article, reframing our system of value to, instead of seeing people as what they will achieve in some future or what they will succeed at or how well they do in school, or, you know, we have to keep their grades up now, otherwise they're going to be, you know, not succeeding in the future. I mean, there has to be a balanced way in which we support people. And then when we recognize that we're imposing an ideology or a set of relations on them, that has really devastating effects. And in terms of our children with disabilities, you know, completely marginalized during the time of COVID-19. And they need what they need in every single day: respect, accountability, relationship. They need community to show up for them. It is everyone's responsibility in our communities, according to our teachings, to look after our kids, to look after all our relations with diverse ways of being. And that's still something that I'm trying to, you know, have conversations about. You know, this idea of special education where children are funneled and siloed away, they're segregated away, and it's supposed to be better for them, right? It's supposed to be for their own good because now they're getting specialized instruction. It physically removes them from the community. It creates a division and a stigma attached with that separation, where it becomes normal, quote, normal, for them to be separated, to be seen as other, to be seen as needing all this extra support, you know? And there's a way to get at this and think about it within a way of caretaking for all people, where they have a sense of inclusion, they have a sense of belonging, not inclusion, right? And so for me, you know, the DNF values are to value our land, to value our language, our life, our people. And that comes from this beautiful concept of eh, which is a life way, which is a way of living, a way of being, a way of having relationship in a way that ends towards and works always towards this aspiration of beauty and balance. And that's literally a different value system. And for me, that's kind of, you know, the answer in terms of how do we kind of rebuild education systems? How do we handle these really complex systems that we're involved in? And how do we kind of counter, you know, this view of, you know, the ways in which just everything we've talked about, everything that we see that we just don't want in our communities, right? They're not good for all of us.
The most important thing I wanted people to take away from this article was an amplifying of disabled voices and experiences in our understanding of what it means to occupy this social political moment of COVID-19. I tried my best to, you know, take what's often on the margins and put it directly in the center for us to really have a full scope of this understanding of what it means to occupy this space of life and death, and how these conversations of ableism, productivity emerge within this context. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about the rubrics of value and productivity. This does not come at the expense of the actual lived experiences of disabled lives, okay? It's a tool. It helps us make sense of capitalism and these long histories of dispossession. But the focus, the enduring focus, is on the lived realities of peoples with disabilities and kind of the system in which we are creating that is so violent and damaging. And it happens in the everyday. It happens within everyone's kind of everyday discourse, right? And so my call is for people to think critically about disability justice and move beyond treating it like a set of check boxes. You know, we address ableist language, check. We include subtitles underneath our images and photos, check. We describe ourselves in video and audio. Those are all important and valuable, and we should continue doing those things. But disability justice is not a set of check boxes. In the everyday, people are contributing to this system of violent systemic ableism. This article is really trying to point that out, bring to the fore kind of our own complicity, our social complicity, and asking us to critically reflect and think about the ways that in which we perpetuate that. And what else is possible? And, you know, what else is possible when we start reflecting and holding ourselves accountable in the everyday, and we start relating in a way that makes us understand that we are accountable? We need to have better relational practices. We need to check the ways in which we replicate, you know, these rubrics of value in our everyday actions and discourse. And so that was really something I wanted to bring at the fore of this article. I wanted to amplify and center disabled lives and experiences. The COVID-19 pandemic is not over yet, and it's still a very lived reality of people who are, you know, deeply impacted by this, deeply impacted by the mask mandate removals and the releasing of the different restrictions. And what does that say about our own privilege to, as people, as communities, as schools, to be able to go along with that? And how does it perpetuate a system of violence? And so my call to everyone is to really reflect on that, to think about disability justice critically, to perhaps find resonance between our long histories as Indigenous peoples with our histories of resistance, and be in better relations with our disabled communities and really put them first and foremost at the center and amplify the voices and experiences of this community. A good place to start if you want to learn more and read more is Alice Wong's anthology, Disability Visibility. She has a podcast as well. I recommend that people start there.
That's kind of what I was thinking about. And I've really wanted to bring the end of the article back into focus to show that, you know, Diné people do have agency, and that they are reenacting these systems, and they are alive. They're not just an aspiration. We saw it happen with mutual aid efforts. We saw it happen on the ground with community building. So the Diné people do have agency and are consistently acting resistance in the face of ongoing colonialism through waves and waves of hardship. And I really just wanted to drive that home, you know, to all our allies and people in solidarity, and just remind gently that even people who have, you know, strong understandings of capitalism and are anti-capitalist in their kind of pedagogy or theory also at times enact very ableist views and ways of approaching their work. And so, I mean, there's work for all of us to be done in this area. You know, we all can continue to work towards an end of, you know, doing the best we can to caretake everyone in our